I'll show you politics in America. Here it is, right here. I think the puppet on the right shares my beliefs. I think the puppet on the left is more to my liking. Hey, wait a minute. There's one guy holding up both puppets. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control.
Read my lips.
Just send your cash.
There has never been so many lies, so much deception.
Doesn't anyone notice this? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
Please clap.
It's time for the Mike Madison Show, a new breed of conservative talk. Now, here's your host, Mike Madison.
Showtime! All right, good morning. Welcome to the Mike Madison Show here at 103.9 WYAB. I am your host, Mike Madison, here 9 to 11 each day, offering up a safe space to the independent thinkers out there, beholden to no party, no politician. Next hour, we will have our Freedom and Prosperity Hour with Americans for Prosperity. Forrest Thigpen going to join us today, so we'll talk to him. I want to find out, I'm still confused on what's going on with the infrastructure bill on the national level, what got passed, what didn't, what got cut out. So we'll talk to him a little bit about that and then about what we're expecting from the legislature here in the state going forward into next year, and how Americans for Prosperity, what kind of things they're going to be championing coming up, trying to move, again, Mississippi off of the bottom of the rungs. So that's Forrest Thigpen next hour. Boy, there's a pretty stunning story about the FDA we need to get to today. I just continue to beat the drum. This is one massively corrupt organization, and if this story doesn't convince you of it, I'm not sure exactly what will. So we'll get to that in just a second. Quotes of the day today. Glenn Greenwald, this is the journalist, founder of The Intercept, the guy who broke the Edward Snowden story, says, virtually everyone who ends up having firsthand experience with the national media realizes they're amoral liars and smear artists with no scruples who publish and broadcast things constantly that have no relationship to the truth. And the public knows this too. We do. Many of us do. Martin Kulldorff, I ended up on some tweet threads today trying to find some information, particularly about this FDA story. Martin Kulldorff says a scientific community that engages in and tolerates slander, bullying, silencing, and ad hominem attacks is a scientific community that destroys itself and its reputation. We no longer have science anymore. We just got a bunch of political actors addicted to endless grants for their work. Or when it comes to our health community, the science there is certainly based around money and not based around health. Thomas Massie points this out. Thomas Massie, the libertarian Republican congressman from Kentucky, he had a tweet out that said the resentment engendered by Biden's vaccine mandates will last decades. Words fade, but mass physical aggression affected with needles will not. The rare but unfortunate few who are permanently injured will be living monuments to this, to his abandonment of science, law, and compassion. Quite amazing thing we've seen now. And to today's disgusting quote of the day, I touched on this, I think, on Tuesday when I found out that Gene Simmons, the demon from the rock band Kiss, the Hellraisers and rule breakers of Kiss, has come out and I found his quote. He was bashing the unvaccinated. This is Gene Simmons' quote. And Gene Simmons has been a more conservative rock star over the years. But listen to this. Here's the quote attributed to Gene Simmons. If you're willing to walk among us unvaccinated, you are an enemy. I don't care about your political beliefs. You don't have the, and he quotes, air quotes this, right to go through a red light or smoke in a building. I hate this whole delusional evil idea that you get to do whatever you want because of your, and again, it quotes it, rights, and the rest of the world be damned. This is Gene Simmons from the rock band Kiss. I talk a lot about the fact that I don't necessarily care about people's political beliefs when it comes to Hollywood or any of these types of things. If they disagree with me, if they have no power over me, then things like boycotts or just mass outrage, I don't pay a whole lot of attention to it. But I will say how misinformed Gene Simmons is, and people should understand this, that Gene Simmons, if you are like me, in the heroic control group of this mass experiment, he views you not just as somebody who's doing yourself harm, but he views you actually as an enemy. An enemy. Gene Simmons has just made a lot of enemies. Really, really sick stuff. I ran across yesterday listening. I'm not sure if I heard it on the radio, if it was on television. I don't even know if it was on a podcast. I listen to so much media. Might have even been a commercial on Spotify. I'm not sure. There was an ad that I heard yesterday that had to have been from something along the lines of the American Hospital Association. I searched for it this morning for quite a bit of time, and I could not find this thing. It was an audio ad. I didn't see any visuals with it, so it must have been a radio or podcast or something, where they were talking about the nursing shortage in the United States. And they listed off a laundry list of reasons that were short on nurses. It was burnout from COVID. They went down into the fact that nurses were en masse quitting. And I'm so sick I couldn't find this thing. But the best of my recollection, the numbers for one particular month, it was like September. And I want to say it was 300,000 nurses quitting. That can't be right. That's got to be too high. But it was a large number of nurses that quit. I believe it. They singled out one month, September. I'm still going to try to find this ad, or if I hear it somewhere, I'll maybe be able to zero in on the source. But they were talking about this nurse shortage and how terrible it was. One of the things they attributed it to was all of the extra paperwork from insurance companies. And I believe part of the ad's intent was to get people to call their Congress critters and tell them to back down the health insurance industry on all of their paperwork. It was something along those lines. Maybe they're sponsoring some kind of a bill. But it was just pretty fascinating to me as they talked about these nurses leaving en masse and targeted. I'm 99% sure they targeted September as the big mass exodus of nurses, that they didn't include the fact that that was when these vaccine mandates came down. And nurses across the country quit their jobs rather than be experimented on. Those heroes of the past 18 months were suddenly the villains of their workplaces because they didn't want to get a shot. They certainly are familiar with the dangers and the issues surrounding COVID. It's not like these people don't know what they're dealing with. They don't know nurses know better than anybody what the risk reward of any shot is, but they can't be left to that. These hospitals forced them into this mass experiment or had them quit, made them retire. And yet the Hospital Association was blaming it on paperwork. So it's just paperwork issues that are chasing our nurses away. We're going to see this, particularly as this winter comes upon us. And it's coming, I think, starting this week. I think we're getting down into the low 30s. As this next surge comes, you're going to hear from UMC. You're going to hear from hospitals around the country talking about the lack of beds and the shortage of staff. And they're going to have to triage care. They're going to have to make tough decisions when it comes to patient care. Just never, ever forget that this is the same profession that ran out tens of thousands, at least, of good quality nurses that could have provided care to patients for all kinds of different illnesses and diseases that are coming through their doors. They could have provided care for all of us. There wouldn't have been any rationing of care, but they were forced out on these mandates. And this little propaganda piece, notwithstanding, blaming paperwork for it, paperwork which has been around for decades, is so disingenuous. We just need to always remember that this is just another one of these self-created crises. When I come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the FDA. Holy cow. So transparently corrupt and dishonest that it staggers the mind. We'll talk about what their response to a lawsuit was at the FDA when it comes to the approval of the Pfizer shot. We'll do that when we come back. Stay with me. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. So there are starting to be some rumblings out of the legal community against vaccine mandates, challenging these shots. I said trial attorneys may save us all in the end. There's an attorney that is starting to take some action. His name is Aaron Siri, S-I-R-I. And he wrote a piece. They have filed a lawsuit. I'll read a little bit about it. Seeking some information from the FDA. And I want you to listen to the FDA's response, what they have asked a judge for. If you have not seen this, you're going to think I'm misspeaking, but I am not. This is from this piece authored by attorney Aaron Siri. The FDA has asked a federal judge to make the public wait until the year 2076 to disclose all of the data and information it relied upon to license Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. That is not a typo. It wants 55 years to produce this information to the public. As explained in a prior article, the FDA repeatedly promised full transparency with regard to COVID-19 vaccines, including reaffirming the FDA's commitment to transparency when licensing Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. With that premise in mind, in August and immediately following approval of the vaccine, more than 30 academics, professors, and scientists from this country's most prestigious universities requested the data and information submitted to the FDA by Pfizer to license its COVID-19 vaccine. The FDA's response? It produced nothing. So in September, this guy's law firm filed a lawsuit against the FDA on behalf of the group to demand this information. This attorney goes on to say, to date, almost 3 months after it licensed Pfizer's vaccine, the FDA still has not released a single page, not one single page, of what they used for this approval of this shot. Instead, 2 days ago, the FDA asked a federal judge to give it until 2076 to fully produce this information. The FDA asked the judge to let it produce the 329,000 pages of documents Pfizer provided to the FDA to license its vaccine at the rate of 500 pages per month, which means its production would not be completed earlier than 2076. The FDA has apparently justified this by claiming that the rate of 500 pages a month, quote, is consistent with processing schedules entered by courts across the country in FOIA cases, and blames the plaintiffs for its own broad FOIA request. How about that? This is what they say, trust us on. This is what they say they're transparent on. Why in the world? This is starting to remind me a little bit of the JFK files, which Trump punted on. I think Clinton punted first on releasing JFK files, set the date into Trump's term. Trump released a few documents and then punted again and kept things classified for national security purposes. And then Joe Biden has punted yet again just last month. And keeping more of those things, you know, for national security. We can't know what happened 60 years ago to a sitting president of the United States in broad daylight in Dallas, Texas. So I ask any of you out there who are of the opinion that these pharmaceutical companies are just charitable, benevolent organizations doing God's work and providing a saving medication for COVID. Why in the world would it take them? You know, and the thing about these things is these documents are all readily available. This reminds me a little bit also of when Germany wanted to repatriate its gold from the United States, and the United States said, oh, sure, we'll give you your gold back. So the U.S. holds a lot of gold at the Federal Reserve. And I think it was Germany that requested their gold back, and the U.S. said, sure, it's going to take us about 13 years to get your gold back to you. That doesn't really pass the smell test, does it? I mean, it was a lot of gold. And it is heavy stuff, but it's not more than a couple of truckloads full, and one good cargo ship gets it across the Atlantic in just a few weeks, I would imagine. But the United States needed 13 years to comply with a request to get their gold back. This stuff just smacks of absolute corruption. And they're obviously, quite obviously, not committed to this full transparency that they've told us about. I ran across a story about Gibraltar. This is kind of funny. I've seen a lot of these kinds of memes where it said how it started, how it's going. Let's see if I've got this here. In April of 2021 in Gibraltar. Now, CNN ran a piece. Again, this is April 2021. Gibraltar was one of the first countries out of the blocks, like a shot, into the vaccination program, pun intended. And so CNN ran an article about the successes of Gibraltar. This is April 2021. It said, headline was something along the lines of, I would pull up the story, but I swear CNN has got so many garbage ads on this thing, it freezes up your internet. CNN's website is almost useless because of all the spam they hit you with the second that you click onto their site. But the headline was something like, Gibraltar's great success. Early adopters of the shots, they're just doing fantastic. And here was their story in April 2021. People drinking wine glasses in bars and restaurants. Fans watching live soccer and boxing matches. As summer approaches, life has almost returned to normal in one tiny territory in southern Europe. And there's a very good reason why. Almost everyone is vaccinated. Gibraltar, a British overseas territory that borders Spain at the point where North Africa and Europe form the gateway to the Mediterranean, it's become one of the first places in the world to inoculate most of its adult population in downtown. Friendship groups can be seen convening over coffee. There are lively birthday brunches with toasts to a better year ahead. In the Cathedral of St. Mary the Crowned, there's the familiar humming of mass. Signage warning people to wear masks has been taken down. The main street even hosted a return of the Gibraltar Reenactment Association's popular march, complete with red and white historical uniforms, lively drums, and Napoleonic muskets. Well, that's how it started in April. And right now, Gibraltar has one of the highest case rates in the world, with approximately 100% of its people there vaccinated. And I love somebody's comment on that story. Says, I wonder if, like, and it says, like, I've expressed my distaste for people who overuse the word like too many times in like every sentence. This commenter says, I wonder if the like one unvaccinated guy in the whole country is sitting there going, quote, how can this possibly be a pandemic of just me? I tried to do a search on what vaccine they use in Gibraltar, because I want to make sure we're comparing when we're talking about the United States. We are Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson here. I did see a story where the UK had sent Pfizer shots to Gibraltar. And it was really one of the only references in looking through several stories. So I believe Gibraltar has used, at least in part, they've been using this Pfizer shot. They now have one of the biggest case counts in the world. 100% vaccinated. So, again, while our mainstream media here will not report on these things overseas, unless it's in April, you know, when the sun is starting to shine in Gibraltar, you know, they could have done that exact same story about flu season every year. It's April in Gibraltar, in southern Europe. Of course, everybody's feeling better and diseases go away because vitamin D is being soaked back into people's skins, but they viewed that as a great vaccine success story. Not so much now. 100% of their population inoculated. It's one of the world's hotspots right now of COVID. And I would imagine they're going to see draconian lockdowns and those kinds of things taking place there as well. I wanted to talk a little bit today. Well, let me go ahead and get into a couple of these things. I ran across the headlines. Will the TSA be ready for Thanksgiving? It's a mystery. 40% of their agents lack shots. I got to tell you, I'm not a big fan of the TSA at all. And in the people who work for the TSA that have been molesting our grandparents for the past 10 years, 15 years, 20 years since this organization was founded as this part of our, air quotes here in the studio, war on terror. This is the same TSA that has failed about 90 to 95% of the time. They've failed tests of people trying to sneak bombs onto planes. But it's still a massive bureaucracy and another part of the war on terror theater. Keep Americans alarmed, but it's the government telling you that they're keeping you safe. Again, they fail 90 to 95% of the time. that they are tested and trying to sneak explosives, which shows you that nobody's trying to sneak explosives, that terrorism is this boogeyman that's made up by the deep state for the endless war spending. But anyway, I guess at least 40% of the TSA agents do have a couple of working brain cells banging against each other. Can you imagine if 40% of TSA agents walk off the job? There's also a story, thank you to James, who had sent me this story. CEO of American Trucking Association reveals 37% of truckers will not comply with vaccine mandate. A very interesting interview with Chris Spear, president and CEO of the American Trucking Association. During a House Transportation Committee hearing on supply chain issues, CEO Chris Spear shares an internal survey showing that 37% of truck drivers not only said no, but said hell no to the Biden vaccine mandates. To give some perspective of the downstream consequences, the ATA president noted that, quote, if just 3.7%, not 37%, just 3.7%, excuse me, of the drivers left the industry, there would be over a quarter million vacancies, resulting in a catastrophic collapse of the U.S. supply chain. Mr. Spear also shared his opinion the OSHA rule is completely unworkable and unlawful. The consequences are grave if just 3.7% did not work. However, if 10 times that many, 37% of truck drivers stopped hauling products because of the Biden vaccine requirement, American civic society would collapse within days as panicked citizens took to the streets. Desperate Americans would be clamoring for scarce products, and the impact on society could not be measured. I'll tell you what, I've got other stories today. I don't know if I'm going to have time to get to it today. I don't know if anybody's paying attention to what's going on in farming, but there are reports coming, and I've talked to a couple of farmers, as a matter of fact, on some of the costs that are rising. They are putting, between inflation and supply chain, they are putting a lot of farmers, and maybe this is harder felt at the small farmer level. They always seem to bear the brunt of any of the problems. The big agro companies, they can afford a few Congress critters, so they usually get what they need. But some of the small farmers are facing fertilizer issues, feed issues, all kinds of different things. Not to even include, and I don't know if I've got on my notes today, do you know they're running some carbon capture pipeline through the middle of this country? And apparently farmers across the heartland, America's breadbasket, have been getting letters saying that their farms are going to be taken in eminent domain proceedings in order to make way for this carbon capture pipeline that's going through the country. I need to spend more time on that than I'll have in the show today. But they may be setting us up. I'll tell you what. They may be setting us up for some very, very difficult times. The difficult times I've imagined have been a financial crisis for a while, and I've been dead wrong. The Fed's been able to print more money than I could have ever imagined our economy being able to handle. The effects of that are coming now, but we will have a financial crisis, but it may be even worse than that with what we're headed for with supply chains and what they're doing to our farmers. We may be looking at true food insecurity in this country, and I'm not talking about kids who miss a school lunch. I'm talking about seriously bare grocery store shelves. And I got to tell you, we're not a real hardy people. That feels like something the Russians could deal with. Doesn't seem like that's something that America would really be down with. I wanted to talk when I come back a little bit about the statistic came out yesterday. I think we've seen our first year with over 100,000 deaths to the opioid crisis. And I want to make sure people really understand exactly what is causing all this death. If you think this is a bad thing, and I believe it is now the seventh or eighth leading cause of death in the United States now, is drug overdose. There's a whole lot of causes for this, all of them laid at the feet of the government. And I always want to make sure that people understand that exactly how the opioid crisis rolled out and how the response to the opioid crisis actually made it dramatically worse. We'll do that when we come back. Stay with me. We are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WIEB. Next hour, our Freedom and Prosperity Hour with Americans for Prosperity. And Forrest Thigpen coming in today to talk to us about what's going on with their organization and here in the state of Mississippi when it comes to some economic freedom issues. I forgot to read one little nugget as we're talking about the FDA needing 50 years to release the data that they used for the approval of the Pfizer vaccine. The failures in Gibraltar as they're seeing huge spikes. You should just go check out the chart of cases in Gibraltar. They're 100% vaccinated. For some reason, we won't talk about the failure of this thing. And here in the state of Mississippi, I was talking to a listener yesterday. He talked to somebody in the medical community, said, oh, yeah, it's a pandemic of the unvaccinated. No doubt about that. Somebody who works at one of the local hospitals. If there are any whistleblowers out there that can tell us anything different, because I've reported on Maryland, where the CDC director came out, the former CDC director Redfield came out and said 40% of their deaths are in the vaccinated. And there's this story. So we've got Maryland. This is Connecticut. 8 people are dead and just shy of 100 more have become infected with COVID-19 after an outbreak at a Connecticut nursing home. Outbreak at the Gear Village Senior Community, a nursing home and rehabilitation center in Canaan, started around the beginning of October when the nursing home was reporting 3 positive COVID-19 cases. Now, 8 residents have died and 67 residents and 22 staff members caught COVID sometime in the past month and a half. Nursing home officials said 48 residents and 21 staff members have recovered from the virus. Of the 89 total infections, 87 people were fully vaccinated, the nursing home said. Pandemic of the unvaccinated people. Remember that talking point. Ignore anything to the contrary. Of the 89 total infections in this Connecticut nursing home, 87 of them were fully vaccinated. This is what they want to give your 5-year-old child, because they say that's the way that you protect Nana. So we've got Maryland and Connecticut. But Mississippi, somehow in Mississippi, it's still a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Keep telling yourself that. Eventually these stories will come here as well. I'm sure they're already here. We're just not hearing about them. Yesterday, a lot was made on the news about the fact we've had, for the first time, 100,000 people die of drug overdoses, largely driven by deaths associated to the opioid crisis, heroin overdose, and particularly deaths attributed to fentanyl. And I wanted to make sure that that is really put in its proper context. So I've been watching and been talking about watching Dope Sick on Hulu. It is a blistering critique of the FDA and particularly Purdue Pharma, the people who put out OxyContin. The fact that they knew that it was an addictive drug but marketed it as a non-addictive drug. They knew that their information they were telling doctors was false, but the sales were going through the roof, so they just ignored the consequences of it as the opioid crisis ravaged the country. It's the story of a DEA agent and a doctor that gets caught up and actually gets addicted himself. That's the Michael Keaton character. It's a very well put together series, but you know, maybe it's some confirmation bias because I just have the distrust of pharmaceutical industry and the FDA with a passion. But so you've got a pharmaceutical at the beginning of this thing. You've got a pharmaceutical company. Opioids were not largely prescribed for pain because of their addictive qualities. Very seldom used. The Sackler family finds a coating to put onto their opioids that they say makes it a time release capsule, and so you don't get the peaks and valleys. This is how they marketed it. The actual studies of it show that that was just simply not true, but they were making billions and billions of dollars, so they put these opioids out there, and we know what happened with the opioid crisis. Here's where it gets actually even worse. In response to this rising level of addiction with opioids and the problems associated with that, there was a lot of crime. It was very similar to kind of the crack epidemic of the late 80s, early 90s, particularly in the Appalachian states, some of the New England states, people where they had a lot of people who did mining work, quickly got addicted to opioids, and then it swept through the country. It was down in Florida pretty heavy. They had a lot of pain clinics down there. So the government decided to step in. And they started, instead of really helping these people, they just went in with a sledgehammer and said, we're going to cut down on opioid prescriptions. They didn't do anything to address the underlying cause of these people's addictions. And I don't know how many people actually died from the opioids themselves versus, you know, just massive overdose, properly prescribed. And actually, they're getting to that in Dope Sick. So I guess I'll know in the next couple of days as I watch more of these things. But the government cracked down on these things without addressing the problems that people were having with addiction to these things. And apparently addiction to opioids is a very difficult thing to overcome. I know some people who have done it and they will tell you it was hell. So they crack down on these things, so people immediately go to the black market and start using heroin. Well, because we've got our war on drugs, the people who sell heroin in the black market have got to make it as potent as possible. And one of the things that they use to make it potent is fentanyl. And the reason they need to make it as potent as possible is because they need it to be in the smallest quantity possible to smuggle it around. You don't want giant bags of heroin. You want small, tight, easy to hide little bags of heroin if you want to smuggle it. So they started adding this fentanyl, which is incredibly powerful and deadly. So now we've got this situation where they're talking yesterday about the fact that 100,000 people have lost their lives now to drug overdoses. This is actually driven by government policy. Not as many people were dying in the actual opioid crisis itself, even though more people probably than ever were getting their hands on opioids back then. They weren't dying. They were sick people. They were addicted. But they weren't actually dying. They were still alive to be helped. But because of the government's response in this ridiculous war on drugs we have, they just took everybody, cut off their supply of opioids, and sent them into the black market. And the black market does what the black market does. It's called the Iron Law of Prohibition. I don't know how to recite it exactly, but it's basically you're going to continue to find the most potent thing you can smuggle in the smallest packages is how the black market wants to work. And that's what happened. So when you hear this 100,000 statistic for people that in drug overdoses, not to mention the fact that a lot of the drug overdoses that we've seen in the past year, 18 months, have been deaths of despair. Because of, again, the government doing things like lockdowns and mass layoffs, destroying people financially. They've sent them into states of desperation and sent them into these black market drugs, and people have been overdosing because they've been self-medicating for the misery put upon them by the federal government and local governments as well. It is just absolutely amazing when you step back and look at it. And as I've said, you can take just about any problem you want to point to. I don't care what it is. You're going to find a government root of the problem itself. Meanwhile, we continue year after year listen to these same people that create these problems, promising us that they are the key to fixing all of our problems. It is beyond belief that people still, after decades and decades and decades of this stuff, particularly when it comes to the war on drugs, still believe these people that they actually have any ideas on how to address these problems. But the massive rise in drug overdoses in this country is laid directly at the feet of the government and their pharmaceutical company masters that got this whole opioid thing kicked off in the first place. It's worth remembering because it will never be couched that way in the mainstream media. I did find my clips about this carbon capture pipeline. I want to get back to that when we come back. I got to take a quick break. Some of the plans that are going on, I mean, this is one of these things. I haven't really heard much about this. Have you heard about this? This carbon capture pipeline. They're going to start taking these, what they call greenhouse gases. They're going to start running them through pipelines and, I don't know, burying them in the earth. Or I don't know what they do with these things. I haven't gotten to that. But what they're doing is going through the country and seizing farmland to run this pipeline through the country. Of course, this is at a time where they shut down oil pipelines. But they've got plenty of room and plenty of power to, by eminent domain, take farmers' homes. I'm going to let a guy, he does a series on YouTube under the name Ice Age Farmer. He's really very fascinating. I don't know how many clips I can get to when I come back, but he's somebody I'm going to start following and listening to him. He certainly has got his finger on the pulse of farming in this country and some of the issues facing us with supply chains and fertilizer issues and things like that, because this could become a big story if we actually start dramatically affecting our food production. And I got to tell you, seasoned a bunch of small family farms in order to make room for a carbon capture pipeline is certainly not going to do us any favors when it comes to food production. Stick around. I'm going to let him explain to you what's going on.
First, I was afraid. I was petrified. I kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights just thinking how you'd done me wrong. I grew strong. I learned how to.
I am not a prepper per se, but years ago I did buy some storable food. My big concern was a big credit crisis, understanding that the trucking industry relies heavily on credit. And if we, you know, if we had seen a true meltdown in 2008, which we really should have had, we had built up a lot of excesses. If they hadn't bailed out the banks, you would have seen supply chain disruptions in a big way back in 2008, 2009. So not long after that, I bought some storable food, some of this freeze-dried stuff that's good for a while. We need to have this crisis in the next 10 years, or all my friends and family are going to be getting MREs for birthday and Christmas because I've got food to give. But it seems like we certainly, and I don't have time to get into a ton of it today, we'll keep this up on the show as we kind of report on this stuff. There's a guy named Ice Age Farmer that's talking about pretty much farming issues across the country. He talks some about climate change, junk science as well. But he had this to say that I had not heard of before. They're trying to run a carbon pipeline through the country, and they are apparently, he's got a letter here that's being sent out to the farmers just in the past week or so, claiming eminent domain over some farms where they're going to be running this pipeline.
Ladies and gentlemen, American farmers are having their land confiscated through the use of eminent domain. They will not be allowed to farm there going forward in order to make room for a massive carbon capture and sequestration pipeline. These pipelines, there are two such projects, run thousands of miles through the very heart of the Corn Belt, the nation's most productive farmland. There are letters going out now, like the one on your screen, by the thousands, announcing to surprised farmers that we'll just be taking your land, land that you have owned and your family and worked some cases for generations now. There are town hall meetings happening in counties across several states where, for example, Des Moines County Engineer Brian Carter announces, quote, "I don't know for sure that there's a whole lot of say we have in this as a county. I'm just being told it's going to happen. Get off the farms, get out of the way, forget the food. We're building our zero carbon future, and it looks like massive pipelines to transport CO2 from ethanol plants so we can bury it underground." These announcements are particularly salient in light of the fact that even now there are warnings going out from major fertilizer CEOs saying, we're going to have a food crisis next year. There's not going to be enough food to eat. And indeed, this is, quote, a life or death issue. Not having food, it's not an inconvenience. This is a huge issue. And it's particularly stunning because it's happening at the same time as the Biden administration announces they'll be shutting down another oil pipeline. In fact, it's the Line 5 pipeline, which supplies the bulk of the energy the Midwest uses. And you can read here, we'd be facing a 750,000 gallon propane shortage every day. That's how the Midwest heats their homes and their barns and keeps those operations running. Not to mention it's used for drying grains. So this is a full-fledged attack in your face on America, and we need to talk about this. So tonight I'd like to share with you.
So he goes on. This is a 20-minute video. If you want the link to this thing, you can email me, MikeMadison@WYAB.com, and I'll send you this. The title of it, if you don't want to bother to email me, the title of it on YouTube is Farmers' Land Confiscated for Carbon Pipeline Through Corn Belt. The picture of the letter here is from something called Heartland Greenway, and they talk about coming through several of the states, 38 counties in Iowa, taking property for this carbon neutral future. Talk about the taking the equivalent off of 3.2 million cars annually that they're going to start scooping off this carbon and, I guess, burying it underground. The Biden administration is just one of these. It's never too late for another, even worse idea. There have been stories, those of us that traffic in the alternate news, the alternative news community, look, I've been hearing about catastrophes, warnings about food shortages, FEMA camps. It doesn't matter what it is, this stuff out here. I do not, am not somebody who jumps on everything as a giant crisis. But the way the last 18 months has rolled out, the things that we have seen that I could have never imagined happening in the United States, the Biden administration's commitment to destroying the private economy because of things like either the vaccines or this carbon neutral ridiculousness, they are going full speed ahead with this stuff. And this seems to be a fairly underreported story, so I wanted to bring it to you. We'll be following this and probably have more clips from the Ice Age Farmer. I recommend you check him out on YouTube. He's got some pretty interesting content on his channel there. So when we come back, we'll be talking to Forrest Thigpen with Americans for Prosperity. We'll be taking a look at some of the things we're trying to shape positively in the state of Mississippi. We'll be right back. We are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB, and it's Thursday, so every Thursday from 10 to 11 o'clock, we host Americans for Prosperity in here, a great organization fighting for economic freedoms, particularly in the state of Mississippi, trying to advance the ball here, get us off the bottom of the heap with some creative ideas. This week, we are joined by Forrest Thigpen from Americans for Prosperity. So, Forrest, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be here.
Yeah. I was trying to look today. We keep talking. It's this endless saga. I almost hate to even keep bringing it up about special session and all that stuff. Yeah. That's obviously dead. That's gone. But I couldn't find. I saw a link to something and didn't pull through. What was Tate Reeves' reason for not calling a special session?
Yeah, there were some things in the bill that he disagreed with enough to where apparently, I didn't hear him say this specifically, but apparently, if he were to call a special session and they passed it in the form that it currently is in, at least the one, the version he has seen, that he would end up vetoing it. So why would you call a special session for that?
Right.
So he's saying, let's. He had said, as soon as the legislature reaches agreement, I'll call a special session.
Which happened.
Which happened, and they sent it to him, and he had some objections. They addressed some of them, but not all of them. And so now they're close enough to the regular session. And the thing is, if the governor calls a special session, he can dictate the topic. He
right.
can't dictate the details.
Right. He can limit it to just one or two issues or whatever they agree
right.
on.
Yeah. Right. But he can't get down to the detail of saying, I will call a special session for you to pass a bill that does only this
right.
this way.
Right.
But in the regular session, the legislature will have full reign to pass whatever they want and send it to him, and then he'll have to decide whether to sign it or veto it, and he actually has somewhat less control over that. So,
and he knows this.
Yeah.
So it seems a little mystifying to me as to what his I mean, I would take it down to political calculation because I've been kind of surprised by the way Tate Reeves has operated, and I may have confirmation bias in the crowd that I traffic, you know, most of the people that I'm around, yeah. the groups I'm involved with are not happy with a lot of the things he's doing from you know, initial COVID restrictions, praising him for lifting them, being one of the early ones to lift them. But particularly on issues like this, there seems to be a lot of disappointment among Republicans and conservatives that he's doing what he's doing right now.
Yeah, I think his two objections are how much could be purchased, that you could purchase you know, up to 10, basically 10 joints a day, I think
right.
is what it amounts to, with no real other restrictions, I think is how he would portray it. And the level of THC,
right?
I think he wants to see regulated.
Is this coming from Dobbs? Is Dobbs the one that's expressing things, particularly about the THC? I always want to make Dobbs the villain if I can. So, do I have a reason to do that here?
I don't know. I don't know who the governor is listening to, or you know, I tend. This might not be popular on your show, but I tend to give to believe that people actually have a good motive.
Oh, wow, really?
And so I do know from working with him in the past that that the governor has taken positions that were not politically popular.
Right.
Early on, you know, when he was lieutenant governor, on education and tax cuts, and that were because he genuinely believed that was the best thing, not because it was necessarily politically popular.
But he was pretty, I mean, he was pretty vocal about those kinds of things. He seemed like a hard-charging guy. He feels like he's just kind of sunk into the background. You just don't really hear much from him, but he's doing things that, and do they run polls on all this type of stuff? I mean, are they focus group these things?
I'm sure they do.
Yeah. So I may be misreading the room because of my confirmation, you know, the bias that I have in the groups I'm in, but it just seems very odd, particularly on this issue that was so popular and the frustration with the striking down of the ballot initiative process. Right. It seems like there's a lot of dissatisfaction around the country, and the Republicans that seem to be doing well nationally are all about, you know, more freedom and you know, I mean, Ron DeSantis kind of setting the mold, that it seems like the old Tate Reeves might have really taken up the mantle and been a fighter in that way, and I've just been surprised he seems to have been so docile.
Yeah, well, on this issue, I'm hoping, trusting that this is because of a genuine disagreement, but it may be a political calculation. And frankly, I've been surprised at some of the things that he's done that do seem to not be consistent with what he did as lieutenant governor.
Yeah,
you know, he vetoed a couple of bills that Americans for Prosperity supported last year, and that was a great surprise. So it's. And also, as it gets closer to election year, you know, I wonder if that will change any.
Well, that's going to be interesting to see how many things, because ultimately it's going to come down between a Republican and a Democrat, and that makes, you know, a lot of old sins go away. Essentially, people will hold their nose. That's the kind of the famous thing. People hold their nose and vote. But there seems to be a lot of dissatisfaction with Tate Reeves right now. Along those lines, it feels like around the country there is a lot of move to replace establishment, probably on both sides, but particularly on the Republican side. Republicans really seem to have kind of repudiated the old status quo Republicanism. Are we going to see any primary challenges here in the state of Mississippi, be it either to the governor or even in House and Senate races here?
I think so, yeah, especially for statewide. Of course, he had opposition last time. He wasn't technically an incumbent, but he essentially was running as an incumbent. And, you know, it was a fairly decent challenge. And because of the things that he's done since he's been in office that have made a lot of people mad, I do think he will have opposition. I think if Delbert Hosman chooses to run for reelection, I think he'll have opposition. In the legislative races, that's a harder call, because there are relatively few people who are able and willing to take 3 months off and be a legislator.
Right.
And then that is narrowed down even further by people who actually would be good legislators, ones who will be strong leaders, who can draw people to them. That's one of the things that Americans for Prosperity now has begun to look for nationally, and so throughout 35 chapters around the country, is looking for legislators that not only vote right, but that can build coalitions around issues, that can join with others and draw people in,
yeah,
instead of drawing a line and saying we're right and you're wrong,
right,
and you end up with just a few votes each time.
Yeah,
that doesn't accomplish a policy goal. It can stir the people and maybe eventually turn out people like we saw in 20 after Obamacare passed, and even in 2010.
Right, yeah. They used repealing Obamacare for about 3 or 4 election cycles.
Yeah.
They used that as the rallying cry and still whiffed. But yeah.
But that's nationally. It's a lot easier to find people who will run for Congress because, one, that's a full-time job, and two, it's a lot larger area to pull from, population
right.
to pull from. And so for the state legislature, it's just more difficult. But I do think there will be challenges.
It's going to be just interesting. I think the political landscape is interesting now in the dissatisfaction of people, really all the way down to the school board level. I think just people are starting to get more involved at the local level, particularly with the schools. We're seeing a lot of that around the country right now, and I'm just wondering how that translates into a real upsetting of the old school political system, because the system doesn't seem really like it's going to change itself. It's not reforming in response to what seems like pretty widespread dissatisfaction. Machine just keeps on trugging like it's always has.
Yeah, and the difficulty with school board elections is a lot of times they are not at the same time as regular elections.
Right.
And so getting people to even pay attention, one, to know what a school board does, two, oh, there's an election, I don't have time today. You know, I mean, it's just very difficult. And so there have been efforts, and we have made some progress over the years in getting those school board elections at a regular general election time. But that's not the case in all places.
I think a lot of times that can be a benefit, too, though, that if you have a pretty good network of people, if you really work it, if not, a lot of people aren't paying attention, sometimes small voter turnout for something can make it quite advantageous to a challenger, that you can just motivate enough people. You don't need huge numbers to win.
It can be. But if that occurs at the local level with the school board, when you have the school establishment that can put out the word quickly a lot of people, then those people will turn out and support the establishment candidate.
That's true. Yeah.
It's just so it is more, it's more difficult. But you're right. I do think that there's a growing thing. We go through cycles with this. And, you know, I think the 2010 cycle was the Tea Party movement was key to that. And I think we're seeing that again, where there's just dissatisfaction. But this time it's not with seeing that a party is the solution. It's seeing that people who are principled is the solution.
Right. Well, I think I loved the story of the New Jersey, was it the House leader or Senate leader that was beaten by the trucker for $153 is what they're reporting he spent. I absolutely love that. That's an inspirational story to us all.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, we had the Democratic nominee for governor two times ago was, or was it last time? No, it was two times ago, was a truck driver who didn't even vote for himself.
Oh yeah,
because he was a long road trucker and he was all on a load, his mother didn't even know he was on the ballot. So I mean, that's who they nominated. You know, had the Democrats nominated in their primaries.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great story. Well, I wanted to come back real quick. Y'all had a great event last Thursday night up in North Mississippi. I wanted to talk about that, and there was an announcement made there too about a new kind of political coalition, wasn't there?
I was not there, but I do know that there is some move afoot to do that.
Yeah, kind of a Freedom Caucus type thing that's going national. So, I think that's a positive thing that people can look for. It feels like, this is another time that's ripe for another Tea Party style of political movement to come about.
Yeah, and the House Freedom Caucus in the U.S. House is making that effort to try to build that notion of a Freedom Caucus, which is, for people who don't know, that's legislators who join together and say, we believe very strongly in certain principles that are traditional conservative principles, really more libertarian, moving toward libertarian, if not all the way there. And so this is an effort for them to support each other and also to have from the national, the U.S. House Freedom Caucus to have support from there.
Right. Almost, yeah. Well, I think, we're ripe for it. The Tea Party was a very interesting movement. I mean, I think that was, had there been a time in recent memory before Tea Party that you had a movement that was that big and effective, particularly in national politics? I mean, a lot of people got elected with this group of kind of that was a true grassroots thing.
It was, it really hasn't that I'm aware of. I mean, we do go in cycles because when Reagan came in and people thought, okay, and the Republicans took over the Senate at that time. Later, they took over the House as well. But the idea was among conservatives, okay, we've elected the right people. Now we can go back to living our lives, raising our kids, running our businesses. And so they just kind of thought everything was on autopilot.
Yes.
And you had a drift with the Republicans that they drifted away. Meanwhile, the left never rests.
Right.
And they have a long-term view, and they're willing to take bite-sized chunks. And so then in 1994, you had the Contract with America, And so you had very conservatives popular. Saying, yeah. you had people saying, oh, okay, just like with Reagan, he was the leader, and now we have somebody who actually has a vision, even if we don't agree with everything that's on that list, these people have a vision, let's elect them. And then that happened, and then conservatives went back to right. raising their families, running their businesses. So this goes in cycles, and I think that what happened in 2010 was spurred on not necessarily by a single leader or a single effort like the Contract with America. It was opposition to Obama and Obamacare. I mean, those were things that spurred on that helped people who maybe don't normally pay attention to politics.
Right. That's what Tea Party did.
That's what brought them in, is because they saw, oh, this affects me. This is not just kind of just political theory. And so that was what was refreshing about that, is that it was bottom up.
And then the Republican Party establishment went out into this Tea Party crowd and put their arms around their shoulder and said, hey, we really love your ideas. Great to hear your energy. Come on into the party with us. And it's like they absorbed them into the blob.
Yeah.
And it just pretty much, we just didn't see the promise of what that could have been, I think.
Well, another thing that happened with the Tea Party in a lot of places was at the beginning, you had a lot of people, including in the business community and others, that were joining in. And like with a lot of groups, it turns out that the people who are most active and most vocal a lot of times become kind of fringy in the way they present what's yeah. being said. And then that causes some people to say, I don't know. I agree with the principles. I don't know that I'm going to associate with the group.
Right. Yeah. No, I
and
know
that
exactly
causes
what you're
some
talking
falling
about.
Away. And then that snowballs, because then the more that happens, then the fewer want to participate. And so it fades out.
Well, I've looked over the years, particularly the last 5 years I've done this show, and I've done stories on, in the national scene of Republicans who were elected, that we'll always reference, elected for the first time in the Tea Party wave, and they're these Tea Party, and they just vote for some of the most abhorrent things coming out of Washington, D.C., and you realize that Tea Party was either just a label that they slapped on themselves because it was the zeitgeist of the moment to get them into office, and they never believed it, or Washington, D.C. did what Washington, D.C. does, which is get them to go up there and compromise on basically all of their principles.
Yeah. And, well, I remember I worked in Washington a long time ago, and I remember when I came home reading about some bill that was approved, and I thought, if I was still in Washington, I probably would think that was a good idea.
Oh, really?
It really does.
It does
affect
cloud
people.
You.
It really
yeah.
does, because of what you're seeing and hearing. And, certainly there's always an element that's needed for compromising to accomplish something, as long as you're not compromising principles.
Right.
But that becomes kind of hazy, and I think that's why we see some of our elected officials do that too, is because they think they're still being principled.
Yeah.
They don't even realize that they've drifted.
Boy, you see a lot of good in people that I just refuse to acknowledge. You may be right. I may just be cynical. All right, we're talking to Forrest Thigpen with Americans for Prosperity. We're going to take a look a little bit at the infrastructure bill. I'm confused on what ended up being included in this thing because it was massive. It's been pared down. What's left? What's not? So we'll talk about that stuff when we come back. Stay with us.
Right into this world, all alone. God takes your soul, you're on your own.
All right, we're back talking to Forrest Thigpen from Americans for Prosperity. We got a short segment here, Forrest, but I wanted to ask you, does AFP get involved at all in any of these legal challenges? Do y'all ever go to court on things, or is most everything on the policy side?
Yeah, in fact, there was a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision that was styled Americans for Prosperity Foundation versus whoever it was against. And so, yeah, we have a legal team that does that. We also include AFP Mississippi actually filed an amicus brief with the state Supreme Court on the initiative process.
Right.
So, yeah, we do get involved in those.
Well, it's been interesting to watch the stuff with COVID, particularly to somebody, I'm a libertarian guy, so it's been really stark to me, what has happened, and I think that's to a lot of people. And it's interesting when you look at some of the other countries. I'm not a big fan of our legal system, just knowing how how clumsy it is, how slow it can move. To a layperson, I'll talk to attorneys all day that'll go, oh, the courts handle this stuff, don't worry, everything will be fine. But to antsy Americans, you just see, you know, problems in the court system. And the saying is that we have the worst legal system in the world except for all the others.
Right.
And we may actually be seeing that. I mean, there's some rumblings in the court. We just had the stay on Biden's vaccine mandate, and that has been stayed, and OSHA has now retreated. So, I mean, it may be that the courts are the ones that lead us out of this, as clumsy and slow as they are.
Yeah. Well, I remember years ago, I guess this was before the 2016 elections, primaries even, that I said I'm not voting for a president for 4 years. I'm voting for a Supreme Court for 30 years.
Yeah.
And of course, most of the decisions that are made are not at the Supreme Court level. They're at the district court.
Right.
And to some degree, the appeals court. And so those are equally, if not more important. And that's why it's important who you elect as president. Even if you don't agree with them on a lot of their policies, if they're going to appoint good people to the courts, then that is key to sustaining our republic.
Well, did Trump do a good job with that?
Yeah, he did.
And did what? My understanding is that he used the Federalist Society to pretty much give him a list and check off on these court judges.
He did.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, yeah, you may be right. I mean, I guess this Fifth Circuit who stayed the Biden vaccine mandate was that's down in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And directly affects our state. We're one of three states, I think.
Yeah, Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. But that now has been moved to an Ohio court.
Is that the sixth?
I think that's the sixth.
Yeah, I saw something about that. Yeah.
And I've never seen this done before, and I'm not an attorney and don't play one on TV, so I'm not sure exactly how this or when they employ this mechanism, but apparently there's some mechanism where if there are several circuits working on something, then they can draw and see which circuit is going to handle certain appeals.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Like in a hat.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, there are probably attorneys that are rolling their eyes right now that are hearing this. But but that was the first I had heard of that happening. But still, yes. It was a three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit, so it wasn't the entire Fifth Circuit Court, but there were one or two Reagan appointees, and the other one or two, whichever it is, were Trump appointees.
Yeah, well, so that does turn to be important. So I'm critical of Donald Trump in a lot of ways, but the courts, and I think, you know, bringing the Federalist Society in to, you know, which are good authorities to try to get constitutional government.
Right.
So that was certainly a good move too for a businessman to delegate that to them rather than pick it up. Just give it to the political people. So anyway, well, we'll see. The courts may save us in the end. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back, start looking at this infrastructure bill. And then we want to talk about some of the things that Americans for Prosperity has got coming up, particularly your Capitol Day that you'll be doing soon. Okay. All right. We're talking to Forrest Thigpen, Americans for Prosperity. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I tear my heart open. I sew myself shut. My weakness is that I can't do much. And my scars remind me that the past is real. I tear my heart open.
All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. We're talking to Forrest Thigpen with Americans for Prosperity, as we do every Thursday. And so can you break down Americans for Prosperity on the national level was involved in trying to fight against this ridiculous spending coming out of Washington, D.C., particularly with the infrastructure bill. What did we end up with, $1.2
trillion? Well, the total was $1.2 trillion, but about half of that was already in the pipeline to be spent anyway.
Right.
So
that gets confusing to people too.
It does.
It's really hard to tell. I mean, do they never pass like a budget in Washington D.C. and say this year we're going to spend $4.5 trillion and here's how we're going to spend it? Do they all have they always done this piecemeal 1.2 here, 1.6 here? Is that how it's always been done?
Well, no. The process is they do a budget resolution. Where they decide what you just described, and they describe
the big number,
and then they say in that budget package, they say we're going to achieve this by doing this over here and making this reform, and then we're going to give this chunk of money to the Appropriations Committee,
and they'll decide,
and they'll split up the details. But things like entitlement programs, the Appropriations Committee doesn't have anything to do with those. So the budget resolution, if there are going to be reforms, they describe that, and those go to other committees. So they do that, and then you work through the appropriations process, and there's one appropriation bill for basically for all the for each major department. There are 13 appropriation bills. But in the middle of the year, when they realize that what they had appropriated wasn't either enough or they need to move funds around, then they would usually have a supplemental appropriation bill that includes all of the agencies that need extra money or need to move it around. So in this case, these things that we've seen in the last 2 years are highly unusual, where they have these special supplemental, not even supplemental, really, they're creations of their own, these coronavirus.
Right.
And its progeny legislation. So no, this is not a normal thing. But unfortunately, I'm afraid they're getting used to it.
If they get away with it, and yeah. So.
But the answer to your question is that the one. In fact, I saw there was one news article online that I saw. The headline was $1.2 trillion infrastructure package passes, and the very next one was $555 billion infrastructure package passes. And both are right,
yeah.
Because it's a total of 1.2. But for instance, for Mississippi, for the transportation money that's going to come to our state Department of Transportation, it's been announced that we're going to be getting $3.3 billion over the next 5 years. Well, we were already going to be getting 2.6 of that.
Oh, okay.
But there was the federal highway legislation was set to – or law was set to expire as they do, sunset. And so this bill actually reauthorized that. So it's not new money. So they're saying it's $550 billion in, quote, new money.
Yeah, okay.
Of course, it's all borrowed.
Every nickel of it into existence. I think I saw an interview with Michael Guest where he did what appears to be the Republican talking point now, which is bemoaning the spending while talking about the great impacts for their own state. I think I've seen several Congress people say this. So, I mean, it's almost one of these things where Republicans, and I brought it up the other day and played the clip, last year, year before, the Democrats and some Republicans came out of the White House after talking to Donald Trump where they had proposed a $2 trillion infrastructure bill. Yeah. So the Republicans talking about how they're so disappointed in the spending rings a little hollow with me because, it feels like just a political thing to say. So you're saying Mississippi, $900 million extra is really what Mississippi is looking at? Is this going to make any substantive difference to our state?
Well, $700 million can be a lot of money, but one of the weird things about this is that it's going to take a while for the money to actually get out to the states. I mean, it could take years before we actually see the impact of this thing that is supposed to spur the economy.
Right. Yeah.
To help us get out of COVID. But even with that, even with $550 billion in, quote, new money, 110 of that is going to highways. $50 or $60 billion is going to rapid transit, mass transit. That Mississippi won't get any of that. I've got a good bit, $65 billion going to broadband, so the state will get some of that. And then I think it's another $7 billion or something to build charging stations.
Oh yeah, the 500,000 charging stations around the country.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
There's a lot in it. Drinking water, but it was. I will say this, this is something that I think Americans for Prosperity nationally can take credit for, because and people in Mississippi that did this too. I think the outcry at least cut it in half, where it was a $2.5 trillion bill became 1.2 total. And I do think the calls and objections helped not only that, but it also at least confined this to where it's infrastructure
It is.
As people normally think of infrastructure.
Right. So a lot of the social engineering stuff was left out of this. A lot of the kindergarten programs or other things like that that were originally talked about, free college is off the table, yeah. I believe.
That's all in the other bill now.
Yeah. So they are going to come back with a more progressive bill down. Was this just a way for them? It's so funny. Politics is annoying to me. But they were talking about Biden gets this big win. But who is the country really enthusiastic about this? I mean, even on the left, are they just really, oh, wow, we got this infrastructure bill? It doesn't even really feel like a win. It feels like most across the board, everyone's either ho-humming it or realizing this is just a bunch of boondoggle spending that we don't have money to do. Was this just to get something passed so they can say, we did an infrastructure bill, and then they're going to come back with the more progressive side of it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're going to try to.
Yeah.
But, you know, Nancy Pelosi kept putting the vote off for, I think she originally planned to vote at the end of August, if I remember right. And, you know, it's 2 months later because she couldn't get a majority to vote for it.
Yeah.
And I saw Michael Guest the other day, and I said, if for once I was cheering for AOC and her crowd.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Because they were the ones that were holding up the Democrats from being able to get a majority. And in the end, you had 19 Republicans that voted for it as well. And so that's what actually put it over the top. But the fact that it was pared down to just an infrastructure bill, actually, I think is how it also was the only way it was going to pass the Senate, but turned out to be the only way it would pass the House. And so the squad was holding that bill hostage, saying we're not going to vote for this until we get to vote on the bigger social spending
right.
bill. And they finally somehow convinced enough, or the leadership convinced enough people, including enough Republicans, to vote for it, where they overcame those objections. But that other bill is still out there, and that's the one that that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are. They are in the target,
right?
Everybody on both sides, and fortunately, so far they've said we're not going to vote for that bill.
So the progressives really got almost nothing out of this infrastructure bill. They've put all their eggs in the next basket.
Yeah, except for some of the green energy money.
Yeah. How long is it going to take to build 500,000 charging stations around the country?
Years.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
It's going to be 6 months probably before any money from this package goes out, because they've got to write all the regs to go with it.
Yeah. It feels to me like children are running our government. I mean, and special needs children. You know what I mean? It just seems almost bizarre, the weird things that are happening. It feels like a lot of very knee-jerk stuff, and it feels very unprofessional up there. And I talked about this a couple of days ago. I never thought I would long for the more classy days of what felt like very polished corruption. You know what I mean? It was just business as usual. This feels very scattered and chaotic, and just a lot of weirdness without any forethought of anything.
Yeah. Yeah, and it follows the pattern of society in general, that you have such polarization that when I worked up there, the people work together, and sometimes that ends up being a bad result, but
yes.
In a lot of cases it ends up being something that's better, because at least they're listening to each other and saying, oh, yeah, we don't want to do that, so let's make it better this way. And you at least had some unity there. And again, you don't want to compromise principles, but there does come a time where you need to compromise on the path to get there.
My opinion on bipartisanship is generally, and I'm sure there's exceptions to this, but when they do something bipartisan, it seems to be bad. When they undo something bipartisan, it tends to be good, because it's obvious something that has reached a level that so many people are dissatisfied with, they will undo something at the federal level. But I'm always suspicious with bipartisan adding things.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to be the way it goes. All right. We'll take a quick break right now. I want to talk about the things that Americans for Prosperity has got coming up, how you can get in touch with them, how you can get involved with them. We're talking to Forrest Thigpen, Americans for Prosperity. Stay with us.
From all over the world, this is Captain America calling. I built you up when you were down on your knees, so will you catch me now? I'm falling.
All right, final segment for today. We're talking to Forrest Thigpen with Americans for Prosperity, and there have been some changes at Americans for Prosperity here. I was sorry to see it, but I know with big organization these things happen. Stephen Utroska is no longer with AFP here in Mississippi, correct?
Yeah, that's correct, and it is sad news, and it's I believe it's a loss for the state, as if we had made so much progress. But I also will say at the same time, that he obviously was the leader, but we also have a great team.
Yeah,
at Americans for Prosperity, Kate Yates, who's been on your show, and Olivia Hornsby have especially been the key to cultivating a lot of our grassroots activity that then Stephen was able to come in and really inspire.
Well, I think he brought a lot of energy to the organization, so I certainly hope that AFP can find someone equally talented in that way, because now is the time. I think the ideas that Americans for Prosperity have are more apparently needed. You know, I think more people are waking up to this. Kind of makes me sick sometimes when I realize how political everybody has gotten involved in politics. But if we were to ever actually channel that in any positive directions, it could be a great thing.
And that's what Americans for Prosperity was created to be, as a grassroots organization.
Right.
And so we have, over the next year, we will continue to be doing classes, including one that you're familiar with, it's a training. We'll be doing this in different parts of the state. Where people can understand how the system works and then how you can actually have an impact.
We were talking earlier about, other people challenging, people are running for school boards and stuff. Does AFP, can y'all help people figure out how to campaign and how to get involved in politics? Is that anything you do?
Yeah.
If you've got somebody who is aligned with AFP policies, I mean, I would think you'd want to cultivate people that, want more economic freedom in Mississippi.
Yes. That is in the I hate the term tool and toolbox, but I hate that phrase. But it is something that is that we can do. Generally, it would be more of a class type thing where we're saying here's how you generally run a local campaign.
Yeah,
I don't think we've done that since I've been here, but we do have that capability nationally where we can bring people in.
Yeah, okay. So what does AFP have planned? I know we've started talking with Stephen about Capital Day, and that is taking place. Is that 27th of January?
27th of January. And here's the thing about it. It's we've talked some, you've heard me talk some about how to influence legislators, the first item being that they are human and they respond as humans do. So if you go yell at them, they're not going to probably do what you want them to do.
Yeah, that's a shame.
But what they do respond to is numbers.
Right.
And especially if they see that that there are, there is a movement. It's not just one or two people who are yelling at them, but it's actually a movement of people who think rationally and have come up with what they believe is the right way to approach things. So they respond to numbers, especially when they are treated with respect. And, some of them won't. I'm not saying this is going to work universally, but then that's when you look for somebody to run against them.
Right.
And so one of the ways that we can help let legislators know the direction we're wanting to go is in numbers on what we are having as a Capital Day event. So that'll be January 27th, and we'll be bringing people from all over the state, including sending buses to bring people in.
Right.
This is something that that we hope to have a lot of people there, and we'll have a brief session on what the policy issues are that we would like for them to talk about, and then if they want to talk about other things, they can do that. So it will be January 27th. We'll have a luncheon and then have that early afternoon have time for people to go through the Capitol, and we'll have people who know where things are in the Capitol and where to direct them and that kind of thing. So
I think that's great, because a lot of people just won't ever take the time to do that by themselves. Might feel a little awkward, but going as part of a group it'd be a great educational thing. It'd be a great thing to bring kids to.
Yeah,
see how
works. And then that's also part of why. The reason that people don't go is because they don't know what to say or what to talk about. And so that's why we want to do that at the first part of that, is to say, here's how you talk to him. Here are the things that you can talk about. If you don't have something in particular, this is what you can talk to them about. This is what AFP is promoting And if you're going in AFP's name, we would like for you to talk about these things. And one of those is the income tax elimination. There are some health care changes to our certificate of need law.
Yes.
That I know that y'all have talked about on the air. And some education issues and some regulatory issues. Michael Watson, among others, has been working on how to eliminate more regulations that are burdensome to businesses.
Yep.
So we'll be working on all those things.
All right. Is that what right now when the legislature, are y'all kind of readying ideas and seeing mm-hmm. who's going to be sponsoring bills that yeah. are aligned with what you do? So you kind of hit the ground running in January?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, one part of the process that most people are surprised by is that bills have to be introduced by about the second week of the session.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have to hit the ground running if you're going to actually get something done.
Right. Okay. Anything left this year that you're doing, or are you kind of winding down events for AFP right now?
We've got just a couple of small events that are planned, and but most of it is gearing up for the legislative session and the events that we'll be having next year. Again, we'll be having more grassroots events.
Right.
Both here in Jackson and around the state.
Well, we certainly do encourage people to get involved with your organization. Again, it's almost like you've got a grassroots, you've got lobbyists for the people, and particularly freedom-loving people and people yep. that want to see Mississippi do better economically, which is the key to just about everything, really, yeah. particularly when it comes to Mississippi. So we've been talking to Forrest Thigpen with Americans for Prosperity. They're interim director right now. So I appreciate you coming in today, and we will see you guys next week.
All right. Thank you. Well, next week is Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's so right.
Happy Thanksgiving.
2 weeks. No, that's right. Thanks.
How hard you try. You can't stop us now. No matter how